Recordings have started.
Sorry, thank you again. Well, welcome everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the Review of All Rights Protection Mechanisms Subteam for Data Call on the 9th of February at 1700 UTC. On the call today, we have Rebecca Tushnet, J. Scott Evans, Philip Corwin, Christine Durain, Susan Payne, and Cynthia King. We have apologies from Lori Shulman, Kurt Fritz, and Michael Graham. From ICANN staff, we have Julie Headland, Barry Cobb, Ariel Liang, Antonietta Mangiacati, and myself, Michelle Desmiter. As a reminder, please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and please utilize your mute button when not speaking. I will turn the meeting back over to Rebecca Tushnet.
Actually, thanks. This is Julie Headland from staff. I'll just quickly just go through the agenda, and then I'll turn things over to Rebecca. And just to remind everybody, today we're going to start with a discussion of Section 5. We did not finish Section 4, but Kurt is unable to be with us today, so Rebecca is. So we're going to go ahead and start with Section 5 today. And then we'll just also confirm the timing of the next meeting, next meetings at the end of this call. Does anybody have any other business they'd like to add today? I'm not seeing any hands raised, so note for everybody that the Google Doc is now unlocked, and the link to that document is in the Adobe Connect room, so you can follow along in the Google Doc, or you can also follow along in the PDF that we have here in the Adobe Connect room. And thanks, everyone, again, for joining, and over to you, Rebecca.
Thank you very much. This is Rebecca Tushnet, for the record. What I want to start with is Susan's intervention from last time was really important, which is that, in fact, people may fit into more than one of the categories we've discussed, and so we should make sure that everyone who is in a category is asked the relevant questions. So someone who tried several domain names in new GTLDs and didn't succeed may also have ultimately succeeded, and so may count as an actual registrant as well. And we should make sure that we are sending people down the path of both sets of questions that were in that case, without the repeating questions that are simply duplicative. But so the way I would frame the groups we have are the actual registrants in new GTLDs. Who are targeted in Section 4, and then two groups which may also overlap with one and with each other. So there are people who attempted but didn't finish registrations in new GTLDs, and then there are people who would consider registering in new GTLDs in the future, the kind of target audience for the notice. And 2 and 3 deserve somewhat different questions. So in particular, people in Category 2 who attempted but didn't finish should be asked why. And I've proposed an in-their-own-words answer, and then we can follow up with ticky boxes, by which I mean boxes you can check as many as apply, and then further prompts. But I think how the question should be asked would also be a matter for the survey provider to weigh in on. And we can talk about what we might want to suggest, but I think that is kind of the key question we're interested in. And if we find that someone received a notice or received an objection of some sort during the process, because they might not know the name, trademark notice, we ask them what they did. And this is the key question we're interested in, and I think it is worth asking to get as much information as we can, and then giving more specific ticky box options, again, to be discussed with the surveyor. I think it's really important to avoid leading questions here as much as possible. We might want to see, did they think it was not worth the time? Were they not sure about their legal rights? On reflection, did they think, I don't have the right to do this? Were they unsure whether they'd get sued and, you know, fearful of that risk and so on? But especially since a lot of these are going to be hard to frame in non-leading ways, I think it's really important to try and get some general responses first. So in terms of, you know, conversation, maybe now would be a good point to stop and listen to other people.
And Rebecca, Phil has his hand up.
Yes, Phil, thank you.
Yeah, hi. Thank you, Rebecca. Hey, and thank you for your work on this. Before we get into the actual discussing the actual questions, I had kind of an overarching question, which is, you know, some of the other parts of this survey, it's easier to find registries, it's easier to find registrars, but, you know, how are we going to find registrants generally who registered new TLDs, much less that subset who may have received a trademark claims notice and either halted or went on with a registration? I'm just trying to, when we talk with the survey providers, does anyone have any idea how we're going to, you know, try to identify and get these questions to that meaningful subset of the human population or not? So that was my question.
Thanks, Phil. So I think we've discussed this before, and there are kind of two ways to go about it. One is to, you know, try and see if someone in the, you know, registrar space would be willing to send out a survey, and that would get at least people in Category 2, right? Or it certainly has the prospect of finding people in Category 2, those who, you know, tried but weren't able, at least with respect to at least one GTLD. And for Category 3, I think we're at the stage where there are really significant survey panels out there, especially for people doing Internet things. So I think it actually might well be feasible to have SurveyMonkey or one of those providers implement the survey. And it's true, you'd probably have to ask a whole bunch of people before you got the, you know, 500 who had at least tried to register or would consider registering a new GTLD. But I think that's eminently feasible given the existence of these large Internet survey panels. But again, those are my thoughts. The survey provider may have others.
Okay. Thanks for that response. Appreciate it.
So I think that Cynthia has asked a question in the chat. Does SurveyMonkey rely on self-qualification of respondents? So the answer is I don't work for SurveyMonkey, so I can't really tell you. But also, Cynthia, I think it's important to recognize that in Category 3, at least, we are actually talking about potential consumers. So the classic way of figuring out who the potential consumers are is to ask them, is this the kind of thing that you would buy? And, you know, that's generally recognized as a perfectly good screening question for trying to assess the understanding of the relevant group. And so I guess I would have no problem with someone who said, yes, I might well try and register an Internet domain name in the new GTLD. Should I move on? Would it make sense to move on, or any other hands?
I'm not seeing any other hands, Rebecca, so I would think you could move on.
Okay. So, in terms of people who, let's see, where was I? Right, so the next big thing is the sort of general comprehension question. So here we're not interested in people who have received a notice. We're interested in what the target group, that is people who may register domain names in new GTLDs, what they understand the notice to mean. So this is the part where you present them with the language of the notice and then just ask them some comprehension questions. My personal preference would be to ask them first to explain in their own words, you know, what they think the notice means, but the survey expert may think that's too much. I think what we want is the least directive guided responses possible, right? So, on the order of someone else has the right to this domain name, someone else may or may not have rights to this domain name, you know, I will get sued if I register this domain name, I may or may not get sued, I should talk to someone else to figure it out, and so on. And I think in the document, there are a couple of different ways of getting at this. I'm not particularly wedded to any one of them, but I think given the importance of wording, it might not be the greatest idea to try and settle on anything right now. I mean, I may get overridden on that. Christine, you have your hand up, please.
Thanks. This is Christine for the transcript. Yeah, I think obviously you're going right to the heart of the matter here, which is showing a notice and getting some feedback on like sort of what does that mean to you, and does that strike terror in your heart, and are you going to run away screaming? My only suggestion was perhaps we could switch the sort of bracketed suggestions for the provider. So what we really want is tell them what we really want to do is ask comprehension questions. And then maybe we can say, ideally, it would be explain in your own words. But I'm worried, again, about, you know, and I keep coming back to this, about being too dictating about what it is that the, you know, if we get zero responses to a fill-in-the-blank question and, you know, 100 responses to some sort of a multiple-choice drop-down, you know, tick all that apply, you know, tick all the things that come to your mind when you see this, you know, I think we would prefer, even if it's not quite as perfect, I think we would prefer the 100 tick box responses to one or zero sort of I've taken the time to type. So my suggestion just is to switch the brackets and say give the guidance first and then the suggestion for how after. Thanks.
Christine, thank you. I think that's a great suggestion. And let me just clarify. My preference would be for, you know, the fill-in-the-blank prompt first and then guided questions, just so that we wouldn't have to choose. You know, it may well be that people will not give great responses in the, you know, fill-in-the-blank, but we can still then ask them and get our second best. So I absolutely agree that it probably shouldn't be just a fill-in-the-blank box. Other people with comments, questions? All right. Then I think I will continue. So the final, there kind of two things at the end, and we're going through this at a pretty rapid clip, which is great. One possibility is to ask them to imagine that they were going to register, you know, something like Chipotle.sucks or Xerox.careers or, you know, Xerox.copiers even, right? So something that I think we would all have no trouble saying only Xerox should be able to register that, or Apple.farms, and sort of what they'd think in response to those different scenarios, what the notice would mean. Because I think it may well be the case that that people might interpret the notice differently depending on what they thought they were trying to register, right? Because I actually my guess is that somebody looking at that notice saying, you know, somebody else owns a trademark in Apple, do you really want to continue? Who wants to register apple.farms will probably say yes much more often than someone who's trying to register, you know, xerox.careers. But that is a total guess, and it's certainly what we hope the notice will convey, but I'm not sure we know that. And so it might be worth asking the hypotheticals just to see whether that is affecting uptake or not. And Christine.
Christine, for the transcript, thanks. I see where you're going with this. I think engaging in hypotheticals can have value. I worry that it's a little bit of a slippery slope. I worry that a lot of people make decisions based on a lot of nuanced information, and I worry that some people in the broader working group might try to extrapolate too much meaning into that data. So I'm not really opposing it per se as much as really expressing some concerns about is what we're going to get out of it worth whatever sort of mayhem results from gathering the data, I guess. And then my second point is just as a major brand, I guess I would prefer not to be any part of an example, and I'm sure most other brands are the same. So I'm not sure how we would approach that. I know that we'll probably get upvoted on that, but I at least want to have that on the record.
So thank you, Christine. This is Rebecca again. I absolutely understand your point, and yet it seems to me that mayhem is going to occur about the previous question. So, we're asking this comprehension question, and we're kind of asking people to interpret the notice in the vacuum. In a vacuum, we don't know what they're imagining that they're trying to register. I think we'll have the same sets of objections to that as we would to the more exemplar questions. And frankly, I hope that we would actually see a difference in, you know, Xerox.careers versus Apple.farms. If we do, that would be great. It would show that the notice was at least doing some of what we hope it will do. And which is why, by the way, I think we have to use well-known brands. We could ask the survey provider to rotate them so that nobody gets, you know, particularly no ox is particularly gored, or Xerox, I guess. But I feel like that data will actually be, you know, better quality. And I absolutely understand your concern, but I feel like it's going to happen anyway. So, sorry, I have to switching windows here to see what else is going on. Christine, do you want to respond to that, or is that an old hand?
Yeah, thank you. Yes, I do want to respond to that. This is Christine for the transcript. So let me use your exact example. So Apple.farms, do we assume, and I'm not asking if you are or not, but do we assume then that any person who goes to register Apple.farms is narrowly and by default not intending to have any sort of relationship with the brand? I mean, we believe people are good, right? People are essentially good. If you're an Apple farmer and you want to go register Apple.farms, you know, fine. But let's be honest about what we see in cyber squatting. Do we, and I'm a registry, so I don't take that word lightly. Do we trust, really? I mean, do we assume that any person who's responding to this survey would register Apple.farms with a purely innocent motive and no bad faith intent? And I'm worried about a hypothetical making sort of assumptions that any registration of Apple Farm must necessarily not come coupled with bad faith and touch.
So, Christine, let me just respond to that briefly, and then we'll get to Kathy, and then I think Susan handed up. So it's an absolutely fair point. We might be able to, if we go this route and we have rotated questions, it actually might be totally worth testing, right? So I want to register Chipotle.sucks, as a criticism site versus we can give some respondents, you're going to register Chipotle.sucks, and try and sell it to Chipotle so that they could suppress criticism, right? Or Apple.farms, for your Apple Farm versus Apple.farms, and you were going to put up computer-related stuff and hope to make money advertising through advertising revenue that way. I think, actually, we could probably work up some scenarios. And we wouldn't satisfy everybody, but the utility of asking some more specifics is to actually have respondents try and apply the notice instead of in the abstract to general situations. So I think Kathy is next and then Susan.
Hi, everybody. It's Kathy. Becca, thank you for all the work that you've done on this. To Christine's point that we shouldn't use, major brands, certainly not major brands involved in the discussions, makes sense. What I wanted to share is the amazing opportunity, Rebecca, that you've drafted here to actually look at the trademark claims notice and have real people look at it. I have to confess, I'm looking at it now. It says you've received this trademark notice because you've applied for a domain name which matches at least one trademark record submitted to the Trademark Clearinghouse. You may or may not be entitled to register the domain name depending on your intended use, and it goes on from there. And I look at it and I facepalm. Paul McGrady and I drafted this in a weekend. We didn't run it by anybody. We didn't have a focus group. We were on a very narrow time frame. And the idea that we can run it by real people and see what they think of what two, intellectual property free speech attorneys drafted is incredible. It's about time. And so I really think we should run it by. We've got this global audience. Do they even understand what we're trying to share with them? That's kind of a fundamental premise of what we're doing. So I think it's a long overdue opportunity. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathy. Susan?
Yeah, sorry, hi, it's Susan. Yeah, I'm not sure that I'm going to add to the discussion as much as agree with Christine. I completely get where you're coming from in terms of the earlier questions all seem to be in the kind of abstract, and we, of course, don't know what name the potential registrant, the survey respondent, has in their own mind when they're putting themselves in the shoes of someone receiving the notice. But at the same time, we still, although we're trying to pick examples which we think will take them down one path or another, we still don't really know. Xerox.careers, for example, someone may be sitting there hypothetically thinking they might apply for Xerox.careers, and they may be doing so because they are in the recruitment business and they think this is a perfect way to recruit new people, or they may be someone who thinks, oh, this will be a good way to scam people, and I'm not sure how we address that unless we try to pick really extreme examples so that there's sort of only one way you could view it when you're reading it. But I do also sort of second Christine's concern about the many brands are not going to want to be would be unhappy at the notion that we've selected them for this process. And also, unless we choose extremely well-known brands, there's a danger that the person receiving this won't actually know the brand. I mean, I'm assuming Chipotle is some big brand. I don't particularly know it. I don't really know what it is and what it does. And so if you're in a country where that's not really a brand you know, that example doesn't work for you. So unless we're going to pick the really big multinational brands, we don't even know if the people receiving the survey will recognize what they're being asked.
Thank you. So, these are good points. But first of all, my reaction to many brands being unhappy that they've been selected is, I'm sure they will be, or actually, I'm not entirely sure they will be. But that actually shouldn't really factor into our data gathering, it seems to me. If they are useful in data gathering, I believe that's part of the process. And I will point out, in fact, that Coca-Cola and I think there are a couple others, IBM, Chevrolet, those are routinely used in surveys to actually kind of orient people when respondents are being asked sort of what do you think about this brand versus that brand, especially in genericity surveys. So it's not like this is some wild-eyed scenario, but I think it's a quite fair point. If we do propose scenarios, they should be globally famous, they may have to be extreme. Honestly, extreme is better than nothing. If looking at this notice, a average respondent can say, "Oh yeah, I should probably rethink Apple.Farm for parking computer ads," and would think, "I should go ahead with Apple.Farm for an Apple Farm." That's great, and it may be we still wouldn't necessarily know everything we needed to know, but we'd know more than we do now. But I think it is absolutely fair to say that we would need to use well-known brands, and that it's a great point that we need to put in some scenarios, which is I guess that's what I got. So Christine, you put your hand up.
Thank you, Christine, for the transcript. Yeah, I'm not going to die on the hill of not using brand names. I'm just saying that I think you're going to get pushback, and not just from me. I think the entire working group, I think anyone who's a brand there is probably going to push back on that. But I am not going to be the single person to die on that hill. What I'm really concerned about, and I think I mentioned this, is the use of hypotheticals altogether. I love the idea of checking out the notice and asking real people to tell us what they think and would they be scared away and what does that mean to them? And I think that's great, and I think that's absolutely the right path. I just really am concerned about the hypotheticals. Can you, and then Jay Scott asked this in the chat also, can you help me understand what we're going to get from a hypothetical that we could not get from other targeted questions about the notice? I mean, even maybe more than just explain in your own words, but you said, ask more comprehension questions. Are there other ways that we can get at the same information without using hypotheticals? Because I'm just worried that it's going to be misinterpreted. We're going to make inferences. You and I might not, but other people will make inferences about what people intended to their hypotheticals. And I know, yes, it's going to happen to all the questions, but hypotheticals are really dangerous. I think I remember you're a law professor, and I know I was an adjunct for 10 years. Hypotheticals are scary, and I'm just really worried about it. Can you help me understand more about why you feel strongly about including them?
Sure. This is Rebecca again. The reason that I'm proposing them is I think that we are really interested in the question of deterring good faith, non-problematic registrants, right? So false positives versus deterring bad faith registrants, true positives, and we don't know whether this notice has the potential to do that, right? So, among the many things we don't know, and we've debated the data collection on this, is kind of what's the underlying rate of false positives and true positives, which is still going to be an issue. But at least it would be nice to know, once you get to the notice, what does someone who puts themselves in the place of kind of a good faith registrant think when they see this notice, versus what does someone who puts themselves in the place of a bad faith registrant think? Maybe it does scare them off. That would be good. But right now we just have zero empirical evidence. And I think Cynthia is suggesting if we want to make up something where there is, where we can also make up a scenario where there's a pretty understandable fair use, like actually we could make up a famous brand called Horse, and you know, for computers, and say and have, you know, horse.jobs and horse.farm, right? That seems fine to me. Like I too do not want to die on this hill, but I feel like we don't know what people think, what ordinary non-lawyers think when they see this, and you know, examples are the ways that you test that. And indeed, you know, that's why we use them in teaching all the time, because it helps you figure out what the rule is. Let me see. So, Christine, do you want to say more about that?
Thank you. Yeah, this is Christine, and I did put my comment in the chat, but I have a suggestion also. My comment is, I think the problem here is you and I think that you and I could probably sit down, and everyone on this call could sit down over a cup of coffee with 150 different domain names and do a guess. John Berryhill calls it the smell test. He says, I can look down either WIPOs or forums, a list of pending cases, and with like a, you know, 99% degree of accuracy, by simply looking at the domain name, I can tell you whether or not the complainant's going to win or lose. Because you can just kind of tell bad faith or good faith by looking at the domain name. And I think that's what you and I are thinking about here today. The problem is good faith and bad faith is a spectrum. It goes to intent. It goes to what you've done in that intent. It goes to sort of the middle. You can start with good intent and switch to bad intent. And I think when you ask people who maybe never registered a domain name or have only registered one or are kind of new to this process, you know, well, yeah, I'm here to register a domain name. What do you mean, good faith, bad faith? Of course I can register this. Of course I can register that. So we're not asking experts to decide this like you or I or John Berryhill. We're asking just random people. So that's my concern. Here's my suggestion, and I'd like to make a suggestion that we've talked about this on a different question, where we say, we're looking for people to be part of a focus group. If you would be interested after this question, if you would be interested in helping us refine this notice more by answering more detailed questions, you know, please off ramp here. Like, you know, we'll contact you, we'll reach out to you, maybe there's a second survey. What do you think about that, about saying for people that want to know more, that don't think this is a waste of time to dive deeper on this, what do you think of suggesting an off-ramp here?
So, Christine, first, I'm sorry, I have to leave the chat room. I'm still going to be on the audio bridge, so my apologies for that. But I have no objection to that. It's clearly just kicking the can down the road, but you know, if we got more real people, and I guess the other part of my reaction to what you said is, yes, of course, these are people who are not experts. That's why we need to know what they see when they see the notice, right? But you're absolutely right. We don't expect them to notice it, to understand it in the way that lawyers do, and that's kind of our problem. And that's why asking them would be so important. But I certainly have no objection in principle to the focus group. You know, I think that can be quite helpful. I've used it with some other terms of service stuff in the past. You know, you do get slightly unusual people participating, but it's certainly better than nothing for lay people. And I'm sorry, could someone tell me if there are people in the queue now? Because I'm very sorry, but I can't see it anymore.
Yes, actually, Kathy's in the queue.
Cool. Kathy, so this two things. One is we do need to ask staff about focus group and funding, if that becomes an additional issue. The other is I just want to share an example of where examples worked. So we had what I think is actually an even harder problem with the Who Is Review team. We were trying to find not even registered people around the world and ask them about their reaction to the Who Is. And this was, you know, close to a decade ago. So this was, you know, this was hard. And so it was that example. It was, you know, not the survey people, not that our survey people need to go nearly this far, because people are much more familiar with domain names than they are with the underlying domain name registration data of the Who Is database, particularly a decade ago. But it was that sitting down with ordinary people with a computer and showing them an example of a Who Is record. That was the basis of the study. And I just wanted to share, and then I'll stop, sorry, I'm talking long. Mary Wong says there's no budget allocated for a focus group under this data request, unfortunately. Back to you, Rebecca. Thank you.
So thank you, Kathy. I mean, so one possibility would be, I'm certainly open to the idea of asking, a subset of respondents, like, would you like to answer some more questions about scenarios and seeing what happens? And that way we could put it in the main survey. I just think it's something worth doing. This is not something where I can promise to try and get funds of my own, I could try, but then I think we'd also have the same problems that we're having in the main group. Let me take another run at these, and maybe I can sort of make up the horse example and think about what we might do. But to Christine's point that people aren't necessarily going to know what good faith and bad faith means, I guess that's kind of the point. That if that's the case, then we need to see if the notice is at least pointing them in the right directions. So, one possible response would be, I would try and consult some online resource about trademarks, or I would consult a lawyer or something like that, right? Which in some ways would be the greatest answer they could give. So that's it for me. Are there other people in the queue?
Yes, there are. Susan and then Jay Scott.
Thanks. I'm sort of in the queue to ask a different question, so I want to make sure that we finish this point first. So maybe I'll speak to Jay Scott first of all and then come back if that's all right.
Hi there, this is Jay Scott, the director. Can you hear me?
Could you speak up a little? I'm sorry. I'm having trouble hearing you.
Jay Scott, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. As I said in the text chat box, and I'm saying this on the record because unfortunately Rebecca had to have mobile, and I understand that. That happens to me all the time. So, what I'm concerned about with hypotheticals is that the hypotheticals that become very nuanced depending on the facts. And I think you can ask comprehension questions or reaction questions without a hypothetical. You can present the notice to people and say, do you understand what this notice is trying to convey? Yes, no. Does this notice intimidate you from making a purchase? That's probably a leading question, but we can ask objective questions about the notice itself without having to have a hypothetical because, you have to understand fair use, you have to understand trademark rights, you have to understand a whole lot of things. I can't imagine, there very well may be some of the things, they have a right to register apple.farm for Apple products that would be targeted to farm, just because they don't understand trademark law. So I think if we're trying to find out if it is having an intended purpose, I think we can ask questions like that without having to get into the nuance of hypotheticals, which then requires the person answering the question to understand the basic trademark law, fair speech, free speech, fair use, all those concepts, and then look at the notice and say, okay, in example A, that is a clear trademark. So the notice serves its purpose because it tells me that, I just think we're getting too nuanced. If what we're wanting to know is this intimidating? Does this scare you? Do you just turn away? I think when we were, not sure where we were, or perhaps it was when we were in Finland, when we were in Helsinki, I think we had Brett Fawcett come up to us and say that he had, an empirical example of a couple of mothers who were trying to register and one of their things, and they were just totally freaked out by the notice. Completely freaked out by it because it looked like some very intimidating legal document that just scared the bejesus out of them, and they didn't want to move forward. So, I mean, I think we can get that type of information by asking objective questions about the notice itself, the wording itself, what is it conveying, what reaction do you have, it without saying, well, if you were going to register Coca-Cola.soda versus Coca-Cola Sun, how would this affect you? Because I think that is, we are expecting that the average person has a nuance of, well, in one scenario it's correct, in one scenario it may be incorrect. I mean, I don't know, but I just think we're adding levels of complexity here and nuance here that we don't need to get to the type of information we're wanting to do, which are people, average people, understanding what the notice is set to do, and is it having the intended consequence, or are there unintended consequences associated with that?
So, J. Scott, thank you. Let me first say, I'm certainly not saying we shouldn't ask the abstract comprehension questions. If people in the working group believe that those are the only questions that whose answers they want to pay attention to, they can do that, right? Certainly within their capability. But it seems to me there's two things. One smaller thing, which is I don't think our mandate is limited to, terrifying people or not. I mean, if we want to answer that now, yes, it turns out it's terrifying some people. But we also, I think, are asked, can we improve it? And we need to know a little more about exactly what it's doing if we are trying to improve it. If the real answer is that there's nothing you can do, it's either terrify people or nothing, well, that's important information. But maybe there are things that could be better. And maybe there are non-terrifying ways to present the information. That would be great. Then in terms of the broader picture, what it seems to me that you are presupposing, and it may well be true, is that lay people are so ignorant that they can't make this assessment themselves. But A, that seems completely contradictory to the idea behind the notice, which is that it would give people some notice to which they could react. If you really believe that people are so dumb they shouldn't be able to register, or I'm sorry, not dumb. The average person is so rationally ignorant of trademark law that they just wouldn't be able to make the assessment, then I don't know why we're giving them notices in the first place. We should be doing something else, whether it's barring them or having a trademark examiner review it or something. But the system presupposes that people can make thoughtful choices. And, yeah, examples won't get at every case. Of course they won't. But it'd be nice to know if the notice were capable of helping people make rational choices. Maybe it's not. That'd also be useful to know. Thank you. And I'm sure there are hands now. Can someone let me know?
Yes, Susan has her hand up.
Well, yes, I do, although it wasn't particularly to respond to that point. I mean, I think, I'm still in kind of agreement with J. Scott and with the concerns that Christine's been expressing. And I think we can get the information we want by asking the various questions, without the hypotheticals. I do think we can. We talked about this quite early on in our work, and I think most people in the working group think that the notice is probably not ideally phrased and could benefit with improvement. So I mean, you know, yes, we must do data-driven development, policy development, et cetera, but I mean, I think we're all expecting that the responses we'll get for this will be exactly what we already know they're going to be, which is, if you're not in the, you know, not in the field, and, you know, not an expert in this area, not familiar with trademark law, you're not, you know, you're probably not going to understand the notice, and therefore, you know, I'm not sure how much extra we get by the hypotheticals that we don't get from the other questions, and frankly from the kind of already the anecdote that we've had. I think you know, I don't think there's any dispute in the working group that we all think it would be a great exercise to have a go at improving the notice. But I guess I'll put my... I just want to flag before we finish that I did have a point about the earlier questions that I do want to make, but I think we should keep going with this conversation first. So I'm going to sort of put my hand down and put it back up again.
Okay, well, actually, I wonder if I could ask you to do that now, just because, you know, I hear what you're saying. I do think that we could get useful information about whether people are understanding, you know, the kind of basic things that the notice is saying, with some actual examples to work with, even if it's a, you know, hypothetical horse famous mark. But let's table that, and I hear you. Could you say your other thing, please?
Sure, and really, it was just a question because, and I'm sorry, I may have missed it when you explained, but I, the sort of various bullet versions above, the ones without the hypothetical, there are sort of a whole range of questions that sort of are kind of asking the same thing in different ways, and I just wasn't really clear about why that is, and I'm not sure if that's because you're just suggesting alternatives, and the idea is that. You know, working with the survey provider, we'd work out what's the best way to express this, or whether you're viewing them as all eliciting different information that's relevant. And it was just a kind of question. If you could kind of clarify, that would be really helpful.
Yeah, thank you for that very helpful question. I mean, you're absolutely right. I was thinking of them as sort of alternatives to present to the surveyor because, you know, I think as what we saw with Section 4 demonstrated as well, it's just really hard to formulate non-leading questions. And so so I was sort of throwing them out there, but I do think that the wording, that there are several different ways of asking the same thing, and we should try not to be redundant, but here are some possibilities. Let's talk to the surveyor. But absolutely.
Thanks, Rebecca. That was really helpful.
Are there other hands?
There are no other hands at this moment.
So the only other thing that I have after that is just this sort of catch-all question, which I think now, based on the discussion from last week, should be moved up to the beginning, basically trying to catch people who didn't know exactly what happened, but who know they've received some sort of objection. And, you know, obviously, based on the discussions from last week, the wording can be tightened up to at least try and limit it to, you know, trademark objections to the domain name. But I think it would be quite helpful to see, to just ask, to see if we can find people who don't really know what happened, but something did happen. And so I'll just say, based on last week, I would actually sort of propose not having that separate, but doing it up front with the stuff we discussed with Kurt.
And Rebecca, Christine has her hand up.
Thank you. Christine?
Hi, thank you. Christine again. So just so I'm clear, we're talking about, if we're looking in the PDF, and you might not be there, so I'm just going to read it. The part that's currently highlighted in purple, if you have registered a domain name, have you received any kind of objection to your choice of a domain name? If yes, what was it? URS, UDRP, letter from lawsuit, don't know, not sure. Is that the question we're talking about?
Yes, Christine, thank
you. And that one you're suggesting goes at the very top before we decide if someone is a potential registrant, a would-have-been registrant, a never-got-to-be registrant, whatever it is we decide. That's correct?
Well, no, it would be, you know, they would actually have to have registered in order to be asked that question, right? So people who are only in Group 3 wouldn't be asked that question. But if someone was perhaps in Group 2 and Group 3, we might want to ask them.
Okay, I'm going to continue going back and forth with you just so I'm clear. I'm not arguing with you at all. I'm just trying to figure it out. So we want to find out what type of former current registrant these are. And so you're proposing that this question precedes the I'm going to show you the claims notice?
Yes.
Okay. And then after that, after you get the answer to this, then you can go to the claims notice. I see. Thank you.
Are there other hands?
Yeah, I'll just leap in it, Susan, Rebecca. I'm not arguing either, but I'd assumed that this, after the discussion last week, would move into the effectively into the domain name registrant section to the extent that it's separate to the and I recognize that arguably those pots of people are kind of the same people and then they get targeted down one route or another. But that had been my assumption, that this is about someone who has registered domain name, so they aren't a potential registrant, they're a registrant. Am I wrong?
Thank you for that. Actually, so my understanding of last week's conversation was, especially you know, after Susan's really important point, is that, yeah, these are overlapping buckets, and therefore we actually have to consider the questions to them as potentially overlapping. So now there are people in that I would call potential registrants who could have had this happen to them. So I would call people in Category 2. So if you're only in Category 2 or only in 2 and 3, like tried and failed, would consider it in the future, I think of you as a potential registrant, right? Or even if you just tried and failed, you know, you certainly wanted to be a potential a registrant, that makes you a potential registrant in my mind. Although it does make sense to merge these categories in the way that the surveyor, you know, asks them and then send people down different paths, I do also think of them, at least some of them, as potential registrants. I hope that answers your question.
Sorry. Yeah. I think it does. And I'm happy to take credit for the comment. By the way, I've been taking credit all call, but I'm not sure it actually was me who made this point. But I'm happy to be associated with it. I think it may have been Christine.
Oh, really? Then my apologies if I misattributed it. I didn't want to take credit for it myself, but if I've been giving credit wrongly, then I apologize.
That's okay. It's just Christine's usually the one that comes up with really sensible suggestions.
And I'll just note there are no hands up at the moment.
Well, you know, this has been a really useful discussion. I wonder if I should be able to give you back a couple minutes of your time after staff reminds us what we're all supposed to do next?
Sure. And Rebecca, just for some clarification, did you want to take a first cut at making edits, or would you like staff to try? Staff is capturing notes, so we will send those out right after this call. But it seemed that, you know, there weren't specific textual changes, more, you know, discussion around the approaches and so on. So, you know, we'll leave the document unlocked if you would prefer to make the edit.
I'm happy to make the edits. Am I allowed to make changes in the text? I ended up sort of unclear about this. I guess I would prefer to make at least some of these changes in the text, like, you know, moving any discussion of did you receive any objection at all up towards kind of the front.
Yeah, you are allowed to make the edits yourself, and that's really actually preferable. So the way the document is set up right now is that you can go ahead and edit, and it will show up as a red line.
Okay. Okay, so I'm happy to take a first pass at that.
All right, wonderful. Thank you. And I see also J. Scott has a question. What's the status of the survey provider RFP? And for that, I'll defer to Ariel, please.
Thanks, Julie. This is Ariel from staff. So the status right now is we have received interest from several vendors. There's actually six at the moment, and we will keep this space open till Monday next week. And then following that will be an interaction period where vendors can ask questions about the RFP and we'll respond. So we do have quite a few interested vendors.
Thank you very much. And J. Scott is saying thank you, Ariel, and good news. And then I guess the final item on the agenda is just to remind everybody we will meet next week at the same time. So, and I think we have completed the discussion of Section 5. If Kurt is available, perhaps we can circle back to Section 4. Otherwise, we also have Section 6 to address. Is there anything else anybody wants to say before we sign off? And Phil is saying, sounds good. And we have a couple people typing. And, just thanks to all of you for joining today. This is extremely helpful, and I hope you have a great weekend. And we'll talk to you next week. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye, all.
Bye.